Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
Hey, Kirk, you've been dabbling in our last episode, you talked about you went on Amazon and you got a hold of the supplier or the manufacturer to get parts. But that circuit board you got made me think that they probably didn't make those circuit boards. They had a contract manufacturer, or even it was outsourced completely. But it made me think is that oftentimes we specify things like, you know, functionality or size or color or all kinds of stuff for the parts we're trying to buy when they're custom. And other times we just say, hey, we need a 100-ohm resistor, and we get 100-ohm resistor of a certain format, you know, like through a hole leaded one. And your biggest decision might be, do you want bent leads or straight leads, you know, kind of thing. But the issue I find, whether it's a module or a subsystem or a complete system you're outsourcing, is that the specifications almost, or the requirements or the contract almost never covers everything, right? It, like on your situation, what if the team that was cutting those leads wasn't a stable process and those were just too long? And that would be, you know, like three steps before they got to the manufacturer of your oven. And
right.
Like, hot. So what are the issues? Go ahead.
You have a supply chain that has each one of your component manufacturers has a supply chain too, like the encapsulants for semiconductor chips for the plastic encapsulated microcircuits. You know, you've got the lead frames, and they may be manufactured by somebody else. You've got a very many, many levels of supply chains coming to parts manufacturer, to the component manufacturer, and then the component manufacturer sends it to the OEM, larger assembly. Mm-hmm. And at each step, you've got to control, somebody's got to make sure that it meets the requirements, that the encapsulating epoxy doesn't have contaminants in it.
Right.
That it has a correct thermal coefficient of expansion properties.
You've been in factories that all of those things could cause failures, but incoming inspection is don't open the box and check that if it says it's 1,000 parts, there's a lot of parts in there. You don't count them. You know, it's a paperwork correct, so we pay the right person.
Right.
And it's straight, you know, what do they call it? Dock to stock for a lot of components. And then you put it right on the machine. And if there's a problem, you find out at the end of the line or it doesn't load or there's lots of scrap.
Right.
But the suppliers do the same thing. They get tape for these reels and it works or it doesn't work. And they don't check the adhesive or the spacing or anything else. It's dock to dock. And the folks with the encapsulant, they're heating it up and putting it on in the molds over the electronics, and they probably check the paperwork to make sure they pay the right person. I mean, the stuff we do, like at HP and Dell, was stock to dock, and if there's an issue, we dove into it. But so why do we expect them to do that? They don't.
Well, and you know, they did. Dell put requirements on their suppliers to do certain tests after the capacitor disaster. That they, you know, you had to test certain capacitors, and you know, it wasn't really. I don't think it may have been very effective, but it's difficult, and you have to. At some level, you have to trust that the supplier is manufacturing correctly, because there's so many parameters, as you just mentioned previously, that you can't control, or you can't always inspect for, or you can't even you can't contract for it. So the quality reputation of the manufacturer of the supplier is what you're dependent on. And if you're big enough, of course, it depends also the size of the company. A Dell and an HP definitely get more, have more influence in quality.
I don't think so. I don't think so? No, I don't really think so. I think the suppliers respond better when there's an issue or a problem than when it's a small company buying a few, you know, 10 capacitors from you. You send it back to them, they'll say, thank you very much, you know, nothing else. But if they get, you know, 10 capacitors back from HP, they're like, all hands on deck, let's find out what the problem is.
Right.
But the problem is that there's two issues I find. One is that what you were talking about is the like electrolytic capacitors is there's a can, there's a foil, it's got electrolytic solution in it and leads, and then somebody solders it and so on. But it's the electrolytic solution itself is made by somebody else, and those constituent chemicals are made by somebody else, you know, maybe two, three, five steps down the road. But if somebody leaves out the, like, I think the issue you're referring to is the...
was phosphorus.
Well, that was in the encapsulants, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that one was the... somebody...
Or something, some material that that provided the electrolyte slower breakdown.
Well, it was for the hydrogen scavenging to make sure it didn't vent. And so that was the one I'm thinking of, is that somebody said, well, I know how to formulate this stuff. I can make it cheaper. And they just kind of forgot about the hydrogen scavenger or thought they had a better solution for it that didn't work.
Right.
But that was, you know, in the overmolding one, that was, from what I understand, the issue was is that the people that made the flame retardant material, which has a certain size to it, somebody changed the screen that separated the sizing, and it became larger, just imperceptibly larger than it should have been. But then it didn't, the epoxy couldn't hold those flame retardant crystals or capsules or whatever they're called in place, and they would drop out and cause corrosion all over the place. It was some vibration, but it was, the issue is that those issues were three, four, five steps up the supply chain. And if we just expect each supplier to do their own thing, it, and vast majority of the time it works, right? But it, the trouble is that the supply chain doesn't have a lot of checks and balances except for immediate problems. You know, this part just doesn't fit. The spacing on the leads is too big and it's the wrong part.
Right, right.
Those kinds of things.
But latent problems that occur longer and over time through fatigue damage or chemical reactions do slip. And obviously that's been the major failures in electronics that, you know, get to the field and are found out later. And there would be no way, I found out later that accelerating the capacitor failure and getting them to vent wasn't difficult if you went to ridiculously high temperatures of, you know, in Celsius, it was 95 C, where I could operate motherboards. But that was really way beyond what anybody had thought of. But I showed that you could do that within a couple hours, what took about 6 months to happen in the field, 6 or 8 months to happen in the field. But it was all too late. It was after we knew the
problem. Then you had thousands and thousands of units out there already.
Right. But, you know, my problem was I was a little bit frustrated that this company had spent years putting PCs in a warm, very hot room, but still you could walk into it, and didn't really look at the units, didn't go and check them every, you know, look inside and see if the component, you know. So, but it would take a long time. And that's why I advocate, you know, stress well outside the specific, you know. But it wouldn't, I was, after the fact, it wasn't like I was going to do this
for every unit or every batch or whatever.
It was only because I wanted to see, well, could I have precipitated this through a HASS or a HALT type process? And actually, a HASS process was way too short. Usually it's only an hour, 2 hours. But a elevated temperature, this is where, as you know, I say there is some stress that generally will show that defect or accelerate that defect once you know the defect.
Right. That's the issue, is you don't know the defect. So we do these other generic things to try to force it to go. But if it takes 2-3 hours at high temperature, a typical halt would step stress until we got a failure. It might take a total of 2-3 hours, but you start lower temperatures and move up. And, you know, it's not always guaranteed you'd have enough stress. And that's the hard part, is if you don't know what the failure mechanism is, then it's hard to know how to accelerate it or detect it. Now, there's a completely second issue here, though, is process variability. And even though SPC or statistical process control and you know, we say we want, like your issue in the last episode, is we want leads to be, you know, half inch plus or minus, you know, a 16th or, you know, using, and as soon as we do that, then they have to convert it to the useful measuring system of millimeters. But, you know, but we set a spec, and sometimes those specs are, and you've seen them on drawings, are completely arbitrary. It's, you know, they have a note on the drawing that says, if it's not specified, it's plus or minus 10%.
Yeah.
You know, and then the designer says, I want to specify these six things I think are critical. Everything else is plus or minus 10%. And so the, you know, somebody's cutting these leads. It's a mechanical action. We're trying to get a length, and the tool gets dull, or contamination gets, or some debris gets underneath it. So they cut a little longer, or they do whatever. But how many times I've never seen somebody measuring those leads and doing control charting to make sure that that process was stable, because it's not always, if it's a through hole board, you almost never see boards sandwiched tight to each other where the leads are close. That's just, I don't know if that's a design issue, or they didn't think of it to specify it, or they did some studies and said, hey, they're cutting it mechanically and it's always the same, close enough. But I think that's the part that I think catches designers, is that they assume the ability of manufacturers to maintain tolerances. And I think that's a dangerous assumption.
Yes. And I know of a particular case where, like, a mechanical hinge, and, you know, laptops have to have this hinge that remains somewhat stiff to hold up the back of the laptop.
Even when you stick cameras on it, microphones on top of it and stuff too.
Right. And, you know, otherwise it eventually will wear out. The laptop's hinge will not have enough friction to hold up the laptop screen. But there was a problem with one of the units, or one of the models, that there was a crack in the hinge around the hinge part, or the actual hinge. And it was, you know, it was a creeping crack that eventually caused a breakage of the hinge. So it was modeled through CAD and experimentation and doing CAD simulations of that hinge and the stress. You get a stress map on the hinge itself through the modeling. And the interesting thing, that the variation that had the most effect on whether that could that crack and where the stress was a parameter, and I don't remember the parameter, but it was not one that was controlled nor known about. And it was some dimension that they had known had an effect, and they couldn't control that particular parameter in manufacturing. And it's just like, you know, what is the precision of those lead cutting machines? How precise can they be? Right. What is the minimum variation those lead cutting machines have, you know, between as tolerances get closer together and boards and spacing and everything. Of course, now it's, you know, I guess there's still through hole boards for heavier components, but a lot of it's surface mount.
Well, a lot do surface mount, but it's, if you can source the through hole parts, and especially for longer lived electronics, those are just solid solder joints. And through hole, you know,
through hole's the strongest.
I remember doing calculations for the pull strength on those things, and, you know, comparing them to surface mount, and night and day difference. Yeah, they're robust parts, but
mechanically going through a board and coming out the other side, and it's very robust. But it has to be. Usually, it's a lot of it's transformers, tall aluminum electrolytic capacitors, heavier components sometimes. So,
well, it's also a really good technique for FETs to get good metal contact into the board for heat dispersion.
You know,
you can really go a long way with it doing that way, getting lots of copper on it, lots of solder on it. But there's the issue is that one is we don't really know, like you were talking about with the hinge, is there's a parameter there that we just don't know about. And like, for example, if you assume that the hinge pin is a circle, right? A mathematical circle. And just assume that and didn't even think about it. It's a pin. We make rods all the time, but there is some concentricity, I think. Is that the right word for it? Where it's more ovalish to some degree. And if that oval is in the wrong spot, it acts like a lever on the housing of the hinge.
Right.
But if you didn't consider that or consider the variation of that concentricity, you're done. Right. I remember years ago, I talked to a guy that worked with the automotive systems and he was working on dashboards the dashboard of a car these days is absolutely phenomenal sets of computers and everything else. But this was just, what's the texture? I complained to him about, you know, sometimes I'm going down the road and I can't see out of my windshield because of the reflection off of the dashboard.
Yeah.
So he said, I should wash my window. But he said, that's actually specified. Is how much that reflectance of that surface material under different lighting conditions. And they basically say, here's a range of lighting conditions that it has to meet this minimum. It has to be non-reflective to a certain degree. Well, but he says it doesn't cover everything. So yeah, it's sunset or this or that. There's some cases that we just can't solve it as a trade-off to it being bad during normal daytime. So he went through, he said, there's like 87 different requirements for the material on the dashboard. It's like they specify this thing to the day, all ends. And he said, yeah, well, it still cracks after it dries out. We haven't solved that one yet.
Do you put the big blinders and on your windshield and front windshield so that the light doesn't crack that, you know, doesn't constantly rain onto the...
I live in California under redwoods. If my son sees... my car sees the sun, it's parked in the wrong place.
Yeah. In Phoenix, it's a little different. I would say you probably want to do that. But then you make better materials. I mean, you know, you may have grown up when I had a Ford... My parents had a Ford Country sedan. Station wagon had a solid metal dashboard.
Oh, really?
It was nothing to cushion your shock there.
Oh, no, nothing.
But yeah, I would think that the reflectivity of that, you know, dashboard material on top, you know, you wouldn't have it, you know, bright gloss.
No, they probably painted it with something or coated it with something to break that down. Yeah, it doesn't do you much good when you can't see out of the windshield. You're just looking at the top of your dashboard.
Yeah. So, you know.
But some people, some organizations spend a lot of time thinking through all the specifications. And I mean, when I was at Raychem, we used to buy polymer from DuPont and then we'd make our heating cables with it. And we would always run a test batch. We'd take, you know, a couple buckets of the stuff and run over to the extruder and run it and then go measure it when it was a finished product and determine if it was what the setting should be for the heating and, you know, get it in range. And about 1 in 10 batches were bad. We'd send 1,000 or 2,000 pounds of polymer pellets back to DuPont saying it's not good. And we had a meeting with
them. Zero response.
There was, well, what's wrong with it? If we knew what to specify, if we knew how to specify what we wanted such that it would always pass, that was a project I worked on for a couple of months. We just didn't know. It was some phenomena. It could have been, I looked at weather patterns. I looked at humidity. I looked at variations in temperatures. And DuPont guys helped me with, you know, all the different things they did on their side. We just could not find anything that correlated to whether it worked or didn't work. And So it was, that was frustrating for both sides.
Why would you send it? What was the qualifier that you send it back?
So we would make a heating cable. And so it's polymer doped with carbon black.
Right.
And at some point, we'd make the core of this thing, the heating element of it, and we'd measure the resistivity of it under controlled conditions. And we then knew how much heat it would generate in different, in a range of temperatures and current and voltage conditions. And if it wasn't within the range for that particular product and size and stuff and loading that we were doing, we knew what the factory knew is that if we did another batch, it would still be bad. And if we did, if we made a product, it would all be bad. It just, it wouldn't meet the requirements of that product. But vast majority of the time, well, not vast majority, but a 1 in 10, 1 in 20 of these batches that would, you know, thousands of pounds of polymer would, were just fine. And we'd be right on the sweet spot and, or a slight tweak to the temperatures and we could get it right in the middle of it. But if it was outside that particular range, it was just bad. We couldn't deal with it. And so we spent a lot of time retesting and analyzing and doing chemical analysis. DuPont did a bunch of their stuff. I got to visit a DuPont plant.
Right.
And it was fascinating. But we, at the end of the day, it was probably an interaction with the, we called it pixie dust. There was a small, just a hint of this additive that had some polymerization type properties to the product a very small interaction with the, you know, with the carbon black, its variability, but we couldn't detect any of those things that would do it.
You might take a sample of your run, you know, of each batch you're doing. And then I'm just like, why couldn't you compare the chemistry? And it sounded like you may have.
Yeah, we did.
Between the batch that you rejected versus all the batches that came in and were acceptable.
And that's what we did.
Couldn't see anything.
No, except, we would, as we started the deal, we started taking samples and I sent them all over to DuPont because they had the capability to do the polymer chain.
Right.
You know, very they were detailed very detailed stuff. And, you know, every chain is a slightly different length. Every chain has a slightly different set of side chains and so on, but they were all, from their point of view, polymer we got 3 months ago and the ones we got today were, for all and anything they could tell, they were identical. And so from a chemical point of view, and but they had slightly different melt points, but within spec, right? But that didn't correlate to it. So part of it was that sometimes at the end of the day, even with the best of intentions and study of it, there's something like that's just, we just don't know about yet. And we get surprised. And that makes for good, interesting research projects. If it's an important, costly problem, you go sort it out the best you can, or you change the design so you're more robust to deal with it. But the
sounds like an ideal candidate for design of experiments.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Matrix. No, and all. If you had the time and ability to do that,
it's we did that. That's where I learned how to do DOE. Yeah,
that's
were deep into the deep end of this. There was like six of us on our team doing it, and like four or five of them on DuPont. But at the end of the, you know, 6 months, we still didn't know. And so part of it, I think the takeaway is that there are things that we can control. There are things that we can set expectations for and contract for with our suppliers. Yet at sometimes we just don't know. But I think it does take a due diligence to think through what's important for your product. What are the dimensions that you really do need to manage and control and make sure they're stable?
Right.
In all of those things. And then couple that with, we used to call it trust and verify. So like, well, then let's go test it. Let's go do our due diligence, find out how it behaves with our, with all the interactions in place. And
yeah, because that supplier may be providing that same material, same component to many different industry, you know,
all kinds producers. Of uses. Yeah, yeah.
Right, right. And so they can't know. I mean, you know, like a little, I was working for a company and a little varactor diode was, you know, having failures. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, God, Toshiba must send out billions of these to, you know, a little surface mount 0402 component to, you know, and they don't, you know, they can't control all. This is just so, it's just so massive. And, you know, what I found was somebody had somehow these varactors had been had a high current pulse through them and shattered the wire inside, or mm-hmm. had exploded, evaporated the wire, but the dye was okay. So the varactor functioned until the molecules inside that channel of the evaporated gold bonds and wire had, you know, not connected. So, mm-hmm. But, you know, that's something that occurred, and they can't, well, when you talk about a reel of, you know, 10,000 tiny varactors, you just can't test every one. You just can't.
No.
That's why your process is in process control, and you have to trust your suppliers. And obviously, you line yourself up with good suppliers that you know monitor their processes and monitor and control and do some lot testing, or, you know, that you don't have to, because if you lot test every component or have to do that, it becomes just quite a burden.
Yeah. And it's part of, I think the part of this is just the fragility of the supply system, supply chains, because we're really looking for lowest cost and quick delivery and all these other parameters that are, and reliability is a function of that. And some get it better than others and do due diligence on it. But there's also just not knowing which parameters or which features that aren't even on the data sheet that matter. And I think that's what makes it so bloody complicated to make a product, is that it's fun. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. So, it's now with our current, as we're after the pandemic, thank God. but now there's a very big chip shortage. So semiconductor problem is holding up the supply chain.
Oh, they're bringing up everywhere. New fabs all the time now. So yeah. It's like, oh, there's going to be issues. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, the car manufacturers are having problems getting the semiconductors. And you wonder if, you know, they're hopefully not compromising on their testing to be able to ramp up the supply.
Well, you've been in that circumstance. That's probably a subject for another podcast, is, you know, ramp issues and bringing up a new line. And but the pressure for these fabs to get the chips out, right, has got to be phenomenal. So that's another issue, is these other pressures we face. So anyway, the supply chain stuff, you kind of sparked it in that last conversation a bit, but it's one of those things that we deal with as part of being a reliability engineer. So if you're listening to this, and I appreciate you hanging on to listen this long into the podcast, you know, if you've got a good supply chain story or something you've learned, especially through the hard way, some Kirk, you and I traded stories on stuff we've learned over the years.
Right.
But I'd love to hear a short story, you know, from you and the audiences. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go. /go/SOR. ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a widget there from SpeakPipe that allows you to record up to 90 seconds. And we then could use that recording as part of a podcast and actually hear your voice and get it directly from you as you join the conversation. Or you could write to us with a comment on that page, or through our about pages. We have contact information there, or on LinkedIn. Lots of ways to get in touch with us. We'd love to have you join the conversation.
Yes, I'd love to hear. I know other reliability engineers have some interesting failure analysis and results. So we'd love to hear that.
And then we all can learn, you know, it gives us insights, and yet another way something can go just not quite right.
We'll deal with that. And I guarantee you, the company itself will not publish it. So you may, you know, have to
mask it a little bit.
But, you know, that's the way we find out and share. That's it. Is that kind of experience and the real
experience. The other way, it's to ship your kitchen appliance products to Kirk and his family. Just reference the last episode. So, all right, Kirk.
All right, friend. Good to talk to you.
Talk to you later. Cheers.
All right, cheers.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.